She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And what I'm going to do is kind of issue a warning for this show. Put your thinking caps on. We're going into high gear thinking today. We've got a great guest. Thank you for joining us. I just want to always mention who the show sponsor is. It's Chapman Tucson. Thank you, Chapman Tucson, for your support and for what you are doing every day with all of your dealerships in Southern Arizona to move them in a greener and more sustainable direction. I'm proud to be a part of that movement. So we really do have an incredible guest today. His name is John Robb. And just for the heck of it, I decided that I'm actually going to read what John has on his webpage about John Robb, because it won't only give you insight as to how interesting, informative, and all of the myriad of things he has accomplished, but it'll also give you a glimmer about his sense of humor, in my opinion, because it's pretty cool. So here it is. Tier 1 counterterrorism operator and planner. That is obviously not the sense of humor part. You know, the guys that got Osama. A successful serial entrepreneur, quote unquote, I built companies, products, and hired people. Inventor, astronautical engineer, top technology analyst, CEO, CTO, COO. Love this line. Professional pilot, author, officer, Eagle Scout, father, husband, and global traveler. So you see the vision of this man, and I love that he put in things about being an Eagle Scout. He loves being a dad, and he loves being a husband, because I got to spend some time with him. So, John, I'm taking a breath here. Welcome, and thanks for being on Mrs. Green's World.
Oh, thank you, Gina.
Are you laughing? I hope you're laughing. I was like, I'm just going to read this, because I've met him, and people want to know. So I just have to do an announcement for one of my sponsors, and then we'll talk about John and his founding of Resilient Communities, about his latest passion, Productive Homes. And then the last part of the hour, I'd like to cover what I call green smorgasbord and get John's opinions on a myriad of issues that I'd like to know what he thinks, like the electric vehicle conundrum. But first and always, this is the spot in my show that I get to do a really sincere shout out for a great company making a difference every day for our health and the health of the planet in another arena that matters, because it's all connected: Safe Cosmetics and skincare products, Ecobella. They are the kind of retailer that John talks about. They're committed to fair trade practices. They pay their suppliers fairly. They are sure of the materials they manufacture, that the products come in. They are really sustainably sourced, and most importantly for me, they work. I never mind repeating this, that it is also great to know when you purchase products from Ecobella, you never have to worry about animal cruelty, which matters to me, and I think it should matter to everybody. They're not testing on animals. It's a company you can trust. So check them out just once and use them forever. I think you will. Their website is www.ecobella2c's.com. And we've got to support companies like this that are doing healthy things for the planet. Okay, John Robb, let's start with Resilient Communities. But what you have to really do, if you don't mind, is give maybe an abbreviated version of John Robb's journey to Resilient Communities, if we can fit that in. Yeah, there you go. I didn't want to say Reader's Digest, because it would be a couple of volumes, but maybe a few highlights.
Yeah, I think I would induce narcolepsy, as I say in my bio. My journey to Resilient Community started with a website I built, about 10 years ago, called Global Gorillas. And, I built that site because, with my military background, non-standard military background, doing, counterterrorism work, but I saw a lot of the analysis going on about where security was going, about how the Iraq war was being fought was wrong. So I reworked it. And what I found was that there is this thing called, you know, open source warfare, open source conflict, where lots of different groups can come together to work as a unit, work as a whole, and get big things done. Sometimes, you know, violent things, and sometimes they can topple governments. And I worked out all the dynamics of that, and the demand was such that I ended up publishing a book called Brave New War about how that works, and that turned out to be pretty popular. And my prognostication as to, you know, where, or my prediction as to where things were going was potentially grim. So as an antidote to that, I developed this idea of resilient communities and started talking about that back in 2007, you know, just about the same time that Rob Hopkins was starting Transition Towns in the UK. So we corresponded and, you know, we were growing at the same time, you know, talking about what resilience means at the local level. Communities that could, you know, take care of themselves even if there's a global system that's falling apart or not working correctly. Did that summarize it enough, or do you want me to?
It summarizes it enough, because we woven through that is the, you know, you had this evolution, and part of it I want to go to pops right into my head is that things didn't look good. And this is not in the script or the many questions I come up with. When you kicked in that you had to do resilient communities and got called to do that, was it your role as a father? Yeah, I mean, you really love your kids. As a husband, as a global citizen, what was the motivating factor? Because it's really a big step to go from global guerrillas and Brave New War to resilient communities. There had to be something going on inside.
Yeah, global guerrillas and Brave New War, you know, the whole open source dynamic that made, you know, open source warfare work, you know, ended up almost defining the last decade. So, it is both from the how the guerrilla war was fought in Iraq with, you know, 100 different guerrilla groups fighting the U.S. Army, all the way through to Occupy, Anonymous. Even then, the folks at Anonymous, you know, were telling me that they were using my work as a something to use as a structure for the organization. And then all of the open source protests that, you know, swept from Tunisia all the way through to Libya. So, you know, it was certainly effective. And I thought, hey, you know what? For the most part, this is going to, you know, cause lots of damage. Maybe there's an open source methodology that I could find that would make resilience and, you know, stable communities and communities that actually produce, you know, high quality of life for the participants, you know, through, and if I can identify that, then we could actually do something awesome. So, you know, that's how I ended up in resilient communities, and I started identifying the factors that make that possible.
And, you know, I sat for 2 days and at the Monterey Bay Aquarium at the Sustainable Foods Institute, which is how we met, and there were lots of presentations, lots of panels, and one of the reasons that you were the first guest I asked Kelly to connect with is because of your definition of resilient versus sustainable. And I think that's really important for our listeners when we're going to talk about what you have in terms of resilient communities. Why resilient versus sustainable?
Well, I have a little bit of a problem with the idea of sustainability. I mean, there are some good aspects, but it's often seen as a kind of an excuse for just constantly pulling back and reducing and reducing and reducing. And, you know, nature is a lot of things, but certainly not that. I mean, you look at the sun, and it's, you know, a huge nuclear fire that is spewing out energy in all directions.
Right.
And, you know, a flare on the sun produces enough energy for a million years at current usage rates on this world. So it's kind of bountiful and abundant in that regard. And then if you think in terms of sustainability, in terms of reduction, you know, pure reduction, you know, the lowest user or the least amount that you can use is the highest goodness, it's kind of tending towards being dead. I mean, you know, your great-great-dead-great-great-grandfather is the most sustainable person you know.
Right.
No, they're not using any water or any energy. It's actually recycling everything. So, you know, I was thinking something a little bit more dynamic. something that fits, you know, better within the context of a constantly changing world. And so I focused in on resilience, and resilience is a dynamic response to things going wrong, to the world changing, versus the kind of sustainable, robust approach, or approach that, you know, tries to keep everything just as it is right now. And, you know, I, the comparison I used was the Terminator robot, you know, from the Terminator series.
Right.
Yeah, and the sustainable, robust robot was the Arnold Schwarzenegger character, made out of that, you know, titanium exoskeleton. And,
right.
And, you know, tried to, it was very, very tough to destroy that robot, you know, but, it, you know, it took a lot of damage. But eventually, over time, the, you know, difficulties that, that Arnold faced ended up, you know, destroying the robot and getting crushed, and it just whittled him down. Whereas the kind of resilient, dynamic approach, you know, pushed intelligence down to the lowest element, and it was that T-2000, you know, liquid metal
right.
robot.
That could morph.
Right? And if you, yes. exactly, if you smash it, you know, every individual droplet was smart enough and had a lot of the capabilities of the whole.
Right.
What's called a scale invariance, meaning that the capabilities of the whole organism is, are seen in the smallest component part. That's a really key attribute of resilience. Well, if you smash that robot, it just kind of reassembles into, you know, the complete whole very, very quickly. And if you think in terms of, you know, the global system, if you smash it, you break it, you know, whether it's an extreme weather event or a series of insults caused by famine or pandemic or something else, you know, Fukushima squared or something like that, the best way for the world to recover from that is through resilience. It, you know, you can break it apart, but it won't mean that it's completely falling apart. It will reconstitute into something that's similar to what it was before very, very quickly.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it totally makes sense. And I know we can't go into the whole presentation that you did, but again, I'm asking you for some sound bites here because we only have an hour. But
oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. What, no, for this one, for this question, no, that was a great answer. How do you, the topic that you talked about was helping individuals, families, and communities to get the information they need to actually become resilient in the face of global diversity. And this is the line that I love, by producing locally. I mean, it's more than just, you know, support your local farmer and support your local business owner. There are very solid scientific reasons why we have to shift our mindset and why that creates a world that works for a lot more of us than from getting everything shipped to us. So can you just expand a little bit on that? That was a lot of what you talked about in your presentation.
Sure. Well, almost all of the problems that we see going on in the world, you know, environmentally, can be boiled down to, you know, global production versus local production. And if you produce more locally, it's less important how much you consume. And it's more important that you consume what you produce locally, produce for yourself or produce for your neighbors. And fortunately, all the technologies that have shaped the world over the last 500 years are making it easier and easier every day to produce more at the local level, whether it's food or energy, water, you know, through water harvesting, and increasingly things, products. And I've been involved in a couple things that, you know, having to do with 3D printing and the like. And, you know, a lot of the, you know, what we're looking at in terms of the future of manufacturing is local production, where you ship the designs, ship the information for how to make it around the world. Now, if you look at it from that perspective, and this is kind of a tough concept to get, is that you start to move into the real benefit of moving towards like an information economy, where the designs and the knowledge for doing stuff is what travels around the world. And the actual physical production occurs at the local level, where you trust the producer because it's either you or your community or nearby community. You know how it's made. You can control for the materials. The beauty of doing it that way is that you don't use all the energy and you don't have all that information overhead, or, you know, that kind of bureaucracy overhead necessary to make that possible. You know, the big companies and everything else that make global production possible. And it's also very, very efficient And it gets more efficient every year and a half or so, because the cost of computing, the energy cost of computing, the amount of energy it takes to produce those designs and ship them around the world, drops by half every year and a half.
And I think you should. I think you should talk a little bit. You know, you said very quickly 3D printing. I mean, I read that blog and it was fascinating to me. And remember, my audience, they're listening to my show to learn about these new concepts, to have hope in some of these ideas. But I don't sit in my everyday life thinking about the impact that 3D printing has on American manufacturing to be able to compete. And I you can wax poetic about that if you like it, if you'd like to, because it's one aspect that people get excited about. I don't think about 3D printing as changing my life, but it will, substantively.
Yeah, I got into it a little bit about 5-6 years ago when I built a global printing system. So it was producing those, you know, high-end marketing documents that, you know, you get from, you know, companies like Cisco and Microsoft.
Right.
You know,
right.
those trifolds and those product sheets.
Right.
You know, the glossy ones. Well, digital printing was making that, you know, the big digital printers, the $500,000 digital printers, were making that possible. And but that meant that you'd produce 100 copies of that and ship it around the world,
right,
using FedEx. And the cost of shipping it was as much as producing it. So we built a global system of 34 different printers all around the world, whether it's Singapore or Frankfurt. And you'd produce it digitally and you'd send it to Frankfurt, and it would be, you know, be printed in Frankfurt, and then it would go across town to the recipient. So it would save all that fuel. And that kind of system really took off, because it not only saved money, it saved, you know, lots of time, and it, you know, increase the performance of the system as a whole, because you were shipping things so quickly.
And shipping and money and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like,
and that's,
it's
exactly
a ripple
the same
effect.
Kind of,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the same kind of thing that's going to happen in 3D printing. Basically, the systems that you're using now to print in 3D are very similar to the dot matrix printers, the old printers that put little dots of ink
right
onto the page.
Right.
And just like you would use a file, like a document file in Word or some other word processor, Google Docs, to print a document on your paper printer, you'd use the same kind of file, but in 3D, you're describing the object in 3D to print the object, using usually right now plastics, but there are high-end printers that are getting less expensive by the day that print titanium parts for aircraft engines, which means that they're super high performance.
Yeah.
And so the difficulty of doing that is going down. So, you know, looking forward, I was a technology analyst for a while, and it's funny because the way I describe my job, and I was like the first internet analyst at Forrester. You familiar with Forrester?
No.
They're the technology research firm that kind of dominated the early internet, and I was their internet guy, and I described my work as helping people to think. It doesn't really matter whether my predictions of the future were correct. I gave you a structure for thinking about the future. And so it ties in nicely with your tagline.
I was going to say, so John, did you notice that? We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, because that's what
I love
people
that.
To do too. It's like, yeah, that was a labor of love that came out of me. It was great. Okay.
And so I'd like the future of the technology points towards a world where you're doing a lot more of the production of everything at a local level. We're seeing a kind of an explosion of interest and innovation occurring at, you know, around the world, whether it's building products, in terms of producing, you know, more food at your household level, or whether it's at the community level, harvesting water, generating energy. You know, I've been tracking how to produce solar energy at the local level, and with the new microinverters, it's now something you can actually install DIY, and you don't have to install a big panel system. You can actually install them individually, which means that you can do a kind of a solar cost averaging approach, where you can put in a panel every month when you can afford it, or every other month, and incrementally increase your installation. And it's all at, you know, AC kind of household electricity level, so you won't kill yourself like you would if it was DC.
That's very comforting, too. I'm glad you figured that out and shared that with all of us.
Well, you know, being AC means that you don't have to put it right next to the power box.
Right, right.
It means you can put it across the street if you have access to it. You can put it, you know, a distance from your house and run the AC line, and you can put it, put them in all over the place. You can put them in, I put some on the side of my house, and it was so non-standard, you know, the building inspectors came over and were like, oh my God, what are you doing? Well, you know, I can put a couple panels on the side of my garage.
Right. Is there
I don't
a
have
building
to go up on my
inspection
roof,
code for this?
Yeah, exactly. It was tough. God. But, you know, forging new ground, showing people that you can actually, you know, put a couple here, put a couple there, put them on the top of your deck, you know, on the deck roof.
Right.
And just in small installations, you know, just enough, just what's affordable to you. And if you do that, you can actually produce income.
And we're going to get to that, you know, and I just got the 1 minute warning to go and break. It's probably 30 seconds now, but I want everybody, I'm sure you all wanting to stay here with us and continue to welcome our featured guest, John Robb, who most recently founded an organization called Resilient Communities. But if you've been listening from the beginning, that's not all he's been doing until he showed up on Mrs. Green's World. Please stay here with us. And John, when we come back, I still have to ask two questions about Resilient Communities before we go on to Productive Homes. So everybody just stay here with me. I would love to talk about foodscaping because I know you like to make up words. And are you prepared? Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We'll be right back with John Robb.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at chapmantucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year.
Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I gave that advisory for the start of the show about putting your thinking caps on. I think that comes from way, way back in Catholic school, and it stayed with me. Not a bad concept. We are so thrilled to be interviewing John Robb, and I made up some more names for him that I just thought, because you heard in the beginning the whole repertoire of things he's accomplished. But I'd like to add thought leader. He is an inventor. He's a game changer. He's an out-of-the-box thinker. And what I so respect is that he's an out-of-the-box thinker when it comes to ideas about preservation of this planet of ours, which is what I live every day to help be a part of. So, John, there you go. Let's go back to Resilient Communities for two quick ones so that we can get on to the Productive Homes. You like to talk, you make up new words, and I love that too. I do it all the time. And yesterday when we spoke briefly, we talked about foodscaping versus landscaping. And I think that you're right. Making up new words creates new behavior. So talk about what foodscaping is and give us some really of the you've got a lot of great rich details about if we shifted to foodscaping in our country alone versus landscaping. John? Uh-oh. We got a glitch in the matrix. And we're just going to call him back. So everybody, we'll just try to get John back on the line. I hope he got to hear me. And I've just got to tell you on air that he's an incredible human being. I went to 2 days of a conference in Monterey Bay Aquarium on sustainable foods for the future. It was an institute. And I'm not making it up. John was one of the people that just absolutely and positively got my attention. He talked to me a lot on breaks. His wife was there. So they're doing incredible things for the planet. And the concept that he has for foodscaping, which I hope we can get him back on the line to talk about, is instead of people having landscapes and lawns, you know, it's if you say organic gardens, that conjures up an image for people. But if you talk about foodscaping, it piques people's interest. So that's what I hope he's going to be able to talk about. We are just trying to get him back on the line, and hopefully he'll answer. And I don't know what's going on. So the other thing is, on his website, if you go to Resilient Communities, it says, are you prepared? And what I want to talk to John about, since he knows so many things, and if you just tuned in, I mean, tier one counterterrorism operator and planner. And as he said, you know, the guy that got Osama, he's a brilliant man. And when he says, are you prepared? I want to ask him,
John?
Are you prepared for what? And how much do you think we all need to sit up and notice about, are we prepared? So we're going to bring him back. We've got him. Glitch in the matrix. Who knows? As I said, I've heard it on NPR the other day. John, are you back with us?
Yes, it went dead. I don't know what happened.
I don't know either. And I did fill in the spot because, you know, I don't have any trouble talking. But what I was telling them about a little bit is when you introduce the concept of foodscaping versus landscaping, instead of saying something like organic gardening, I mean, that is, you know, that conjures up a whole different image. So go about foodscaping versus landscaping.
Well, I mean, foodscaping is, you know, new term. And it's basically taking your entire yard, your complete yard, and converting it into something that produces food. Not just like a little section or a little part of it. Converting the whole thing. And the areas that you do keep as grass, you know, you can actually improve the soil that you have there by putting in clover. And actually, you know, fix some nitrogen into the soil because, you know, we're sitting basically we currently have lawns that are, you know, very expensive to maintain, a lot of work, a lot of money if you get a landscaper, if you don't have the time to actually do it.
A lot of water.
It. Yeah, and they're good for nothing because, you know, they're dependent on fertilizer. You know, just like a drug addict, they need that fertilizer, and they're just about an inch thick in terms of, you know, what they have in terms of a productive soil. So if you don't give them fertilizer and water on a constant basis, they just die. Can't be used for a garden and can't be used really for anything. So by converting to a foodscape, you change the entire dynamic. You know, you're starting to produce food for your home, and if you design it correctly, or if you get help designing it correctly, it actually can be something that produces food without much work. A lot of it has to do with actually how you design it, design the water flow along the, you know, as water flows through the property, rainwater flows through the property. It also changes the whole dynamic of landscaping. So instead of just having money go out to a landscaper, if the landscaper is a foodscaper, they can actually help you produce food. And if you pay them, you're actually paying them to produce food for you, which then more than pays for the cost of actually getting that help. So your net revenue positive on her yard versus negative.
I mean, I just have to ask you this. When I think about it, like today, I was wishing you were coming in studio to Mrs. Green's World to do mm-hmm. the interview, because then we could like spend the rest of the day talking. But we're in the desert Southwest, and
right.
where there's an out of the box organization called Tucson Backyard Gardeners, and there are gardens all over the place. But for someone like me, what we did before the Mrs. Green journey is we went down to basically, you know, Xeriscape and made everything drought resistant and put everything on drip so that we weren't using a lot of water. So in your vision, would my yard, I mean, it's like it blows me away, because there's so much unused space that could be used for food, but I would need that foodscaper guy to help me keep it going. So it's like
yeah.
a sustainable, or, you know, I don't want to use sustainable, but resilient concept of it's lasting. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I originally had been focusing on resilient communities, what you could do at the community level in terms of starting local
right,
businesses
right.
and building everything from, you know, community greenhouses to you know, maker spaces
right.
to promote
community
3D
gardens,
manufacturing.
Right.
Yep. And I found that I got more traction with helping people make their homes more productive.
Right.
And in this regard, you know, how do a foodscape, even in you know, very arid areas, you can actually be very productive in terms of capturing the water. You know, there's lots of things you can do based on, you know, all this new knowledge that's being kind of unearthed and tweaked and improved upon, being shared, you know, around the world using, you know, the global network we have access to.
And 3D like, printing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just getting knowledge as to, you know, I've been spooling up and trying out and, you know, actually employing it on my yard, things like hugel culture. And it's a technique from a permaculture farmer in the Alps, Shep Holzer. And he's been doing it for 40 years, independent of any kind of permaculture movement. And he had the worst landscape available.
Right,
it was like
the Alps.
Cold.
Oh my
yeah,
God.
It's cold. It's 6,000 feet or
no
so.
Kidding.
And it was just a rocky slope. And what he did is he created terraces using wood, rotten wood. And you can either use rotten wood or biochar, which is even a better
right. Oh my gosh.
Kind of soil amendment.
Right.
But it's more expensive to produce and more labor intensive. Poor man's kind of biochar is to take rotten wood, stick it in a trench, and cover it with soil. You can be, you know, sod turned over, and then you then top it with compost and everything else that you can get your hands on. And that wood serves as a kind of a structure accelerator for the things that you know, plan on that. And what I do is I typically put in sunflowers in the first year
right.
on my terrace. The terrace captures water that's flowing if you have any slope in your property.
Right.
The water gets stored in the structure of the wood. The wood serves as kind of a hotel for the microorganisms. And it just is amazing. I mean, I'm getting 8 foot tall tomato plants.
You have to send me some pictures.
Oh yeah,
I put that up on the Facebook post about the show.
I'll send you my sunflowers from this year on my second terrace.
Oh my gosh,
14 feet tall.
Unreal.
I mean,
and they're beautiful. Like, who doesn't love a sunflower? So there's all that aesthetic joy that it brings to the cosmic energy of the planet. Everybody's not depressed because everything's brown and green.
Yeah, and I actually put it in my front yard.
I
have a backyard and a front yard, and I'm in the process of getting my neighbors all on board. They're not used to it. They, you know, they're thinking in terms of kind of like the golf course front yard.
Right.
But the whole aesthetic is changing. And this is the good thing is if you've changed the idea of what the American home looks like, American suburban home, you can actually change the whole dynamic, because people will start to look for that when they purchase a home. And if a home isn't productive, doesn't have a foodscape, isn't collecting water or doing water harvesting, isn't producing energy, at least to sustain it, you know, completely covering existing needs plus producing more as an income, then it's not a home you want to buy, because it's going to cost you.
So we've segued into what your new concept is and what you're excited about and working on, excuse me, which is the productive home concept. So let people think about what you're thinking, in terms of what a productive home looks like and why it's so important for the planet, for all our sakes.
Yep. Well, a productive home is the home of the future. It's where everything is going. It's a home that produces. It produces food, energy, water, and occasionally things if you do 3D printing or manufacturing, which is getting very easy to do. In concert with your neighbors and your community, it produces a lot of what the community needs. So we're not talking off-grid here. It's a complementary. It's like taking 60-70% of what you consume is done at a local basis, produced at a local basis. It changes the whole dynamic of the way economics works.
Just shifting 10% changes it. So when you're talking that, that's massive. That's the big game changer. So go ahead. But it would produce own energy.
It's a game changer on a global basis. I mean, just look at it from the food perspective. The underutilized yard space just in suburbia in the U.S. is a trillion square feet. A trillion square feet of what could be productive landscape.
Right.
Producing food. It's huge. We're talking about
the
need for meat production and food production to meet the needs of the Chinese middle class and the Indian middle class is coming on online. Well, I'm not really worried about it. I mean, if you project along current usage patterns, it's a problem. But if we start to adopt this, and I do believe we are, the productive home concept, and we're looking for productive homes, both for economic reasons, because it saves us money, but it's also a better place to live, then the whole dynamic changes. There's so many cool things about being, you know, having a productive home. There's the economic incentive, meaning that you're moving towards a home that pays for itself. Now, think about it this way. Americans have about $22 trillion in real estate assets, residential real estate assets. And these homes that we own, that we've, you know, they're the biggest single investment most
right.
of us have.
Right.
Are completely useless. They're basically consumption items. They're treated as consumption items. They look pretty. They're pretty boxes. And it shouldn't be that way.
Don't do anything. You're right.
Yeah, they're not productive assets.
Right.
We're assuming that they'll be valuable downstream. In the past, that's been the case because, you know, more and more debt was available, but it's maybe not the case in the future. So if we're not going to make any money, if consumption items are just costing us money, taking from 50 to 75% of our income is spent maintaining them, the best way to fix that situation is to turn them into a productive asset. And I think it's starting to change the dynamic. It's starting to think in terms of the future of like economic independence is having access to some sun, some rainwater, and a little bit of land. And it doesn't take much to produce a lot. I mean, we're talking a solar panel setup of about 20 panels is about as much energy as a family of three or four
right,
would
need
forever.
Right.
And if you can afford that, you know, a DIY setup of say, $15,000, you'll have a middle-class electricity needs met for
like no utility bills. I mean, that's
and no utility
people,
bills, exactly.
Seriously, think about that. And water, which is going to become more and more scarce. And from what you said yesterday, reusing every single part of that in ways that will help not only just reduce consumption, but reuse the water. I mean, that's another one. And I have to ask you this before we're going to go to another break soon, but from where you sit and the many perches on which you choose to sit on and talk about, how much of the consumer is going to drive where this is going? Like when I go into Home Depot, we all look for things or home goods or whatever. We look for things to make our homes beautiful. And what you said yesterday really struck me. Will it change so that when I go into Home Depot, it'll say, you know, make your home more productive? Do you think the consumer is there and that the needle's moving forward with all the power in the world, the power of purchasing?
Yes, I think so. And in some small part, I'm trying to work in that direction. What I'm doing with my new effort on productive homes, and I'll have a whole media site and associated content, research content associated with that up soon.
I can't wait.
It's going to be good. I have some good partners and good financing for this. And part of the effort is to find people, individuals, who are innovating in terms of, you know, producing products and designs for products, because a lot of this is open source, has an open source kind of DIY component if you can't afford to buy it as a product, you know, designs for making your home more productive. And I'm going to find these folks, and I found a lot of them already, is help them productize, help them go out to Kickstarter and other crowdfunding places where people pre-buy a product that they're interested in owning. And with those orders in hand, they're able to actually get them manufactured.
Do you know how exciting it is for somebody like me to sit there? I mean, Mrs. Green's World is going to do a Kickstarter so we can kickstart to a more global impact. But
yep.
Doing the research that I've done, there are so many neat things out there, neat, creative, green, innovative things. And I love crowdfunding. I mean, it's to me, it's one of the most optimistic phenomenons of my lifetime. It's like this is shifting, and it's not connected to nonprofits and boards and big organizations.
Oh yeah,
it's smart people with good ideas. It cuts out the middleman. Oh my gosh, I'm getting the we've got to take a break sign.
Okay.
Because here we got it. We're really excited about what's going on. John Robb, founder of Resilient Communities, and soon to be splashing the globe again with Productive Homes. We'll be right back. Please stay here with me. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And when we come back, I really do want to try to cover a little green smorgasbord, because
okay.
John knows a lot about a lot of things. I want to talk about electric cars and, you know, the role government is or is not playing and a couple of other things like that. So stay here with me, everybody. We'll be right back with John Robb.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected automotive magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Did you know that even a donated doorknob can help Habitat for Humanity? Habitat's Habistore accepts donated items like furniture, building materials, and appliances. Donations come from commercial builders, malls, restaurants, hotels, and individuals like you. Then, items are bought by bargain hunters who come across the very things they are looking for, just like the right doorknob. The best part is that Habistore sales generate funds for building homes. Call 520-889-7200 or visit HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, and certainly we are giving you a lot to think about today. I'm so pleased to have as our guest John Robb, who, among the many things he has accomplished, started a website and a Facebook page that rocks called Resilient Communities. You can check that out. It's Resilient Communities, just like it sounds. And John, before we get into the green smorgasbord, one of the things that we talked about yesterday in preparing for the show was the whole idea, and I did more thinking about it, like when I grew up in Jersey, for example, lots of the neighborhoods, like I had lots of friends who were Italians, and the Italian neighborhood, The family that was having kids lived on the main floor. The mother-in-law lived in the basement. And the newlyweds lived upstairs in the, you know, second floor or whatever. And you talk about stability and kids growing up healthy. There are many neighborhoods like that where the home was the place where kids were emotionally stable. It was the place from which they came. And then we all started moving all around the country. I mean, I did.
Right.
And then my kids moved. And I hate that. I hate that they don't live here in Tucson because I love my three daughters and my grandchildren. But is there, there is, and I don't want to be, you know, you told me about the impact on children's emotional stability when it comes to an enduring quality like a home.
Yeah, I mean, I, in large part, you know, focused on the productive home to kind of solve some personal needs. I mean, I've been telecommuting for years, and I as more people telecommute, you'll find this out too. I mean, it's not only, you know, extremely environmentally good.
Right, right.
You're not traveling, you're able to hop around the world. I started companies this way. And it's easy to actually get things done online. I wanted to, you know, if I'm spending all this time at home, I want a home that actually, you know, sustains me.
Right,
you know, makes
right.
me feel good for being there.
Yep.
And there's very few things that actually do that better than having a, you know, a foodscape where I'm walking around in the morning to, you know, to check out my plants to see if my Swiss chard is ready to pick. And
can have a tomato for breakfast off your vine, that makes my mouth water.
I converted a swing set into a bean wall, you know, an old swing set, because, you know, no one's going to use the old swing set.
Right.
And it's just full of beans. I mean, I probably have, you know, 300 beans sitting there, and it's going to continually produce for the next couple months. So it's making my life more meaningful. It's making my home more meaningful to my kids. And what we found is that, you know, the biggest single factor in the emotional stability of children is kind of knowledge of family and familial context.
Right, right.
And you can get that, you know, through a home that's stable and it's enduring. Unfortunately, you know, we make our homes, you know, look like, you know, decorated boxes that are, you know, consumed and kind of thrown away after 20, 30 years.
We do, and the accumulation of stuff. I mean, that's where we are in our life. We have an accumulation of stuff that we don't care about anymore, but we spend a lot of our life accumulating it. And now things like a hawk in the fountain matter a lot more, and the bird feeder we have for the quail and the, you know, the finches. So you're right, it's shifting.
Having the kids come back so they know it.
Yes.
And I already live in a multi-generational house. I built an apartment for my mother-in-law. And, you know, at 85, she travels around the world, comes back, and
and she's,
you know,
safe
has a place
with you. Right. I hope
my kids are
listening, because that's going to be me. I want the mother-in-law apartment.
it really extends your time, you know, living outside of assisted living. And it makes it so much richer, because it took a while, you know, to kind of get her to really open up with the family. And once that happened, it was just amazing.
And so good for your kids. I mean, it's a multi-generational thing. My parents lived in our guest house for many years when my youngest daughter was growing up, and they're so multifaceted assets to this. I can't believe it. So, okay, go ahead. So the home is an asset.
My kids actually want to come back.
Yeah.
I mean, my kids actually don't mind coming back and staying with us.
Right, right. No, mine either. It's like, wow, I love that.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a good thing about that's a silver lining on this kind of economic downturn. You know, as the global system produces fewer good jobs, particularly jobs that require a college education, and kids are living at home, take advantage of that time. It's not a down. It's not a negative. It's actually a very, very strong positive. Because, like, for instance, when I got out of the military and I went to graduate school, you know, I moved my small family in with my parents for a couple of years, and it was a fantastic time to, you know, reconnect
with
my dad and my mother and,
right.
you know, as an adult. So, and, you know, it's an opportunity to actually build that kind of context that lasts long-term.
It's what I call
it. Look at it long-term, you're going to get old.
It's all what's right about the world, and I believe that. And fortunately, my three daughters do too, and we're all trying to figure out how to get back to where we're much more frequent, you know, participants in each other's lives. So
closeness, physical proximity matters a lot.
It does.
And it saves you money. It makes you more economically viable,
it does,
too.
I miss my grandkids every day of my life, and they're a 10-hour drive in, you know, Taos, New Mexico. So it's tough, but we try to figure it out. So I'd like to go down, like I have bullet points that are not connected.
Sure.
But one of the things that I think is what I call a big green conundrum is when people starting waxing poetic about electric cars. And of course, you know, James and I say electric cars, okay, still using electricity from the grid, which here is still using dirty coal. What's your spin on that? Because you've done so much in so many areas. Isn't there a contradiction there?
Yeah, electricity is a funny thing. It's only 15% of our total energy use, so it's a small portion. The grid, the way it's delivered, is mostly underutilized, 80% underutilized or empty during most of the year. And it's only during, you know, peak times, peak usage times, that it actually goes up to 100% utilization for the wires bringing electricity to your house.
Yeah.
Yep, are full. Now, the problem is that electric cars are energy hogs. They chew up a lot of that grid power, almost as much, and in some cases more than air conditioning, even in the Southwest, and that's based on studies and usage patterns. So we already know that air conditioning is a huge user of electricity, and it really strains the grid on those summer afternoons where things are very hot.
Where it's still 100
electric
degrees.
Cars.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. And what happens is when the grid is taxed to that level, it breaks down more often because we're not building many lines anymore, many new transmission lines because of NIMBY. You know, not in my backyard.
Right.
No one wants a new transmission line going through their property.
Right.
And the energy that's produced to meet those peak demand periods is really, really dirty. I mean, we're talking diesel. I mean, it's worse than even the coal. It's
just, right.
You know, and it's very, very expensive. I mean, the power company is paying upwards of 50 times what it pays during off-peak periods for the electricity. Now, the good thing is if you could start producing more solar electricity, then you utilize, you're not any drain on the grid.
Right.
And it goes to this whole productivity paradigm, is like the whole productivity way of thinking, is if I produce more energy, more food and more water through, you know, efficient harvesting off my roof and, you know, building a yard that captures water and utilizes it and makes it stay around and do some productive work, I can produce more than it probably would actually use, and I really have fewer constraints on my behavior.
I just love that you bring it up. It's like really, really that shift in the whole mindset of where we've got to go. Because I can tell you, our electricity, our bill is horrible because we're hot as heck. It's still over 100 degrees here and humid in the Southwest, and I'm glad I can just flick a button. So, yeah, the electricity part is hard. I don't want the time to run out before I ask you a couple of other things, like,
sure,
that go to, you know, we met in Monterey at the Sustainable Foods Institute, and for someone like me, who is all about creating a global community of people who care about the planet, it was extremely successful and useful, and I get to have guests like you on. In your think tank mindset, do institutes like this substantively help long-term about changing the mindset of people? Is there a lasting impact? Because some of what was going on there for me was people trying, you know, they had investment in being right, and I don't say that in any negative way. They're passionate like I am. But one of the things that I liked about you is you're invested in the dialogue and creating a sense of community and being approachable. So do institutes like that help in your experience?
Sure, in the sense that they produce constructive dialogue.
Right.
Of course. You know, I'm very much about taking out the middleman, whether it's in the conversation.
I love that. I know.
And, you know, in finance, you know, taking out, you know, all of those financial folks who make starting companies and, you know, generating a living income from producing, you know, products and services, extremely difficult. You know, you take those folks out and everything gets easier. It should get easier and gets more dynamic. I found, you know, I was involved really early on with blogging, one of the earliest companies I worked on, or back in 2001, I had always thought about personal publishing as transformative.
Right.
And I had written a report at Forrester in 97 that was really popular on it. And, you know, it took 5-6 years before I saw some technology that actually would make it possible. And I joined the company and I ran it. And we did RSS and that, a lot of the early technologies associated with blogging.
Yeah. RSS feed, can't live without it.
Yeah, it's just like one of the first aggregator we built. And, you know, just this whole idea of being able to produce content at the local level as an individual and publish to the world. Now that became Facebook and Twitter and all that other stuff is, you know, as time went on. But what I found is that if you come up with something, you know, some kind of core systems and modules that are templates for doing things that can actually be copied by other people.
Right.
And implemented in different ways.
Right.
The idea can grow virally, and it can just zoom, you know, a pandemic of goodness, you know, sweeping the world. And you can do that in years. That's why I'm so hopeful in terms of how things can change, is that if you can produce more at the local level and we get more people, you know, taking productive homes and their productive approaches to their lives, which is really, you know, in line with, you know, the American kind of mentality, you know, I work hard and I want my home to work as hard as I am, is that it creates this kind of independence of thinking and flexibility that allows you to adopt new economic systems and new ways of doing things that are made possible through, you know, new online networks. And that, I think, has the potential of changing the whole economic game.
And there's never
really,
been a more
really
exciting...
Fast.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, there's never been, to me, a more exciting time to be alive in spite of all the daunting reports that come out every day about, you know, the hole in the sky and how we're doing with all of the climate change issues. Okay, two more quick questions if we have time. What do you think the appropriate role of government is in any of these conversations, or do you think they have an appropriate role, which might be stay out, that's a middleman. Do you think they are leading the charge in any ways that they need to be?
I don't see them leading the charge like they used to. And, you know, the problem is the whole nation state system, particularly big nation states. They're kind of like the odd man out in the global economy. You know, you can do a lot at the local level as an individual, and then you have the global economy, which dictates, you know, whether you're skills are viable or
right.
saleable and everything. And the nation state really doesn't help you much. Small nation states, small countries tend to do better. They tend to be more nimble and more responsive to you know, citizen needs. Like even like Iceland, you know, it was responsive
no
to it's but you know, with 400,000 people, it's smaller than my county. So big countries like the US, they're just kind of their only role they seem to be developing into is surveillance states, and that's scary. I mean, I don't need that. I'd rather opt out.
Oh my gosh, and I've started saying things on my cell phone, and I'm just like, well, what the heck, you know, they're listening anyway, so not that I'm doing any covert operations.
I call that an info bomb. The idea is that, you know, if you have information on everybody, that if it's ever released or leaked, and it will cause irreparable harm to everybody, then you don't build it. Especially if it's your own citizens, you know,
Okay, so we have less than a minute, maybe a little bit more, over a minute. So for people that want to stay connected with you, how do they? Is Resilient Community still the best way? They can sign up for the newsletter?
No, I mean, that's all handed off.
Okay,
I mean,
so how do we stay in touch with John Robb?
Okay, the best way to get in touch with me and stay in touch with me is to watch Global Gorillas. And
okay.
Just type in John Robb and Global Gorillas. I'm not there's only one other John Robb that's pretty close. It's a punk rocker commentator in the UK. But
I found that in a Google search. I'm like, oh, that's
yeah, and
him.
I'm the other guy. And I have a wiki page and on Wikipedia.
And they can stay
Global
in touch
Gorillas,
with Mrs. Green's World, because I'll be staying in touch.
Yeah, I'll have the productive stuff up within the month.
Okay.
So
awesome.
The productive home, and we'll get all that going. And what I'm going to do is I'll have the free site, and then I have, just to support me doing this, is a kind of an ongoing research site where I have a research blog as I find new stuff, as it goes through my kind of mental frameworks for thinking about stuff. I put it up there Some of it makes it out to the free site. Some of it makes it into you know, monthly reports.
Well, you are amazing, and I will be in touch. Thank you, John Robb.
All right.
Next week, Dr. Joaquin Rees from the University of Arizona, Vice President of Innovation and Strategy, Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts and Sciences. This is going to be another mouthful. Dean of the College of Science and Professor of Geosciences. He's my friend, and I can't wait to interview him. John, thanks for all you do for the planet, and you're going to be staying connected with me.
All right.
Make it a great green week, everybody.
It was fun.